Good morning. It is 8:06 on this Thursday, July 16th. I'm Christine Weller, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on the Local News Hour. It is 55 degrees Fahrenheit in Park City right now. The high today is 86 degrees, 65 over in Heber with a high of 93. Going to be mostly sunny today, then showers are likely this afternoon. Here with a more in-depth weather update is ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back on this Thursday. We are going to be looking at partly to mostly cloudy skies as we go throughout the day. We will have a chance of seeing some scattered showers and thunderstorms popping up this afternoon as we see some of that monsoon moisture flowing into the area. Of course, these showers and storms, if they do develop overhead, could produce some heavy rainfall, some gusty winds, and some lightning. And that rainfall could become heavy in a short period of time, and that could lead to some minor flooding out there. So we'll keep an eye on that. Temperatures will climb into the mid-80s in Park City this afternoon, with high temperatures climbing into the low to mid-90s still in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into Friday, I do think we see a little extra bump in that monsoon moisture moving across northern Utah. So I think a better chance for scattered showers and thunderstorms arrive across the northern half of the state, including the Wasatch Back. Not necessarily an all-day rain event, but I do think it's pretty likely Friday, Saturday into Sunday that we do see scattered showers and storms each afternoon. Temperatures on Friday will be in the mid-80s for highs in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures climbing into the lower 90s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Saturday, high temperatures will be in the mid-80s in Park City with highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. And we'll keep that story going for your Sunday. Mid-80s for Park City, highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Again, a good chance to scatter showers and storms Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoons. But remember, not an all-day washout. We're talking about maybe a passing thunderstorm, and then you'll see things clearing up. But just be aware, there could be some showers and storms around. Heading into next week, this monsoon pattern looks to be staying in place. So, hey, we're going to keep those daily chances for showers and thunderstorms. Temperatures will slowly cool down, I think, as we head into next week, with high temperatures going from the mid-80s in Park City to kick off next week to highs only in the low 80s by the time we get towards your Wednesday. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we'll see those highs going from the low 90s into the upper 80s by the middle of next week. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, Summit County Councilmember Kenneth Hart will recap last night's meeting, including discussions on basin rec bonding. Then Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward and Planning Commission Chair Kristen Van Dyne discuss plans for Bonanza Park and Park City Mountain's proposed lift upgrades. Then local singer-songwriter Harry Lawson Peach shares his writing process and details an upcoming show. After that is Cool Science Radio at 9 o'clock. Engineer Adam Hauk explains how technology inspired by heated car seats is keeping surgical patients safer by maintaining body temperature during complex operations. Then biologist Li Jing Sun talks about the weird and wonderful world of reproduction, where sex-changing fish, self-cloning reptiles, and other mating types reveal evolution's inventive nature. All that is coming up. Park City Manager Adam Lenhard says April continued this year's trend of low sales tax numbers. Revenue was down almost $112,000, or about 5%, compared to April 2025. The figure excludes transient room taxes from hotel stays and short-term rentals.
We have the numbers for April, and what we're seeing is a continuation of a very weak winter.
April accounts for about 5% of annual sales tax collections. According to a staff report, the shortfall suggests the abnormally dry winter with record low snowpack affected spring activity more than expected. Earlier winter sales taxes showed more resilience this year, but citywide collections for February through April were down almost 12%, or about $1.9 million. The lackluster winter hit hardest in March, when sales taxes were down about 20% compared to 2025. Still, Lenhard said there's a bright side. Year-to-date collections are only about 4% lower than in 2025, which shows the city's adjusted budget absorbed most of the shortfall.
The silver lining is that the broader sales tax base showed some great resiliency, and so that gives us a little bit of cautious optimism as we look forward.
The staff report says the clearest area of pressure remains overnight visitor spending. Transient room tax was down almost 32% compared to April 2025. May visitation and lodging projections suggest the situation will stabilize further into the summer. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. A nanny accused of injuring a baby has cut a plea deal with Summit County prosecutors, avoiding a second jury trial. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports she's also barred from working in childcare.
34-year-old Lindsay E. Johnson was set for a jury trial in September, her second on charges related to allegations that she seriously injured a child in her care. Instead, she pleaded no contest to one count of third-degree felony aggravated child abuse on July 10th. Third District Judge Richard Mrazek sentenced her the same day to 1 year in jail and 3 years of probation. Since Johnson already spent a year behind bars, she won't serve any more time unless she violates the terms of probation. As part of the deal with Summit County prosecutors, two other felony counts were dismissed. The plea also bars Johnson from working in the child care industry or any job where she might supervise children during probation. Summit County originally charged Johnson with 8 second-degree felony counts of aggravated child abuse in late 2024. The Harriman babysitter was accused of injuring a 6-week-old Summit County child she cared for overnight in November 2024. According to court papers, the doctors at Primary Children's Hospital found the infant's injuries were consistent with shaken baby syndrome. The baby would survive the incident. In May, a jury acquitted Johnson of 5 counts but split on the rest, resulting in a mistrial. By pleading no contest, Johnson is accepting punishment without admitting guilt. As part of the plea, a protective order also prohibits Johnson from contacting the family of the injured child. She will be on the Child Abuse Offenders Registry for 1 decade after completing probation. And while on probation, Johnson cannot commit any new crimes. Mrazek could send her to prison for up to 5 years if she fails to comply. A restitution hearing is scheduled for September 25th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Utah has ranked as one of the worst states in a recent CNBC list examining the quality of life across the U.S. The list graded states based on crime rates, air quality, health care access, worker protections, and civil rights laws, among other factors. Despite its natural beauty and access to outdoor recreation, Utah was ranked number 47 for lack of primary care providers and was docked points for its poor air quality and high ozone levels. Coupled with the state's minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, which covers about 16% of the cost of living and only 513 licensed child care centers, CNBC gave the Beehive State 95 out of 260 points, an F. While health, child care, worker protections, and air quality were low, the state scored well for low crime rates. Georgia, Louisiana, Indiana, and Texas also received failing grades, with Tennessee named as the overall worst place to live in 2026. And online with me, I've got Summit County Councilmember Canice Hart here to recap last night's meeting. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi. We're talking a little bit about Basin Rec today. Basin Rec's director was back at council yesterday to explain why the district is looking to issue up to $150 million in bonds. It's for 2 field houses. Could you just summarize the proposal for those unfamiliar?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, first, what Basin Rec is doing with the county council is asking to go out and ask the people to vote on the bond. So I think the biggest thing for everyone to realize is that in the end, people will be voting whether they support the bond or not. It won't be a council decision. The council's choice is just simply to say, yes, you can put that on the ballot or not. And what Basin Rec is looking to do is to expand their facilities into the Silver Creek Village area and potentially over into the Jeremy Ranch side at the Klein Dolly parcel. And what they're making the case for is that their facilities are overwhelmed now. And with the additional growth that's coming, you know, through additional residences at what is the Dakota Pacific area and elsewhere, that they see this as, and Silver Creek Village expanding out, that they just see their demand is so high that they need to increase the facilities or the offerings at the facilities. And so the meeting yesterday was essentially them making that case.
Okay. Why is the council waiting to vote on this? Why not put it on the ballot right now?
Well, you could, but we wanted to make sure it was down in the Snyderville Basin area. And since the meeting was held in Colville, we thought, okay, we'll use this as information. Let's get the council members up to speed. And then let's have the, I believe it's going to be August 5th, but let's have a meeting at the Sheldon Richens building. So people that actually would be affected or that would be the ones that would vote, because not everybody in the county will vote in this. It will be just the affected people from a tax base so that they could come to the meeting and then they could ask the questions and they could get more information. So it's really just about getting people more information.
Okay. What's your opinion of the amount? I mean, $150 million sounds kind of like a lot.
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole thing is a lot. It's an interesting one. As a council member, I like the idea that the people get to vote. So in that sense, from a council perspective, I think putting it out to the people so that they have a say is the way to go. On a personal level, I need to get more information myself because I definitely see where they're being overstretched and the facilities are really kind of maxed out. But when I look at tax bills, as a resident who pays into that tax, my property tax, I pay as much for Sutterville Basin Recreation and my property tax as I do for fire and all my road maintenance combined. So I think that's going to be the conversation to be had. And I look forward to Basin Rec making their case and, you know, getting out and talking to the people. And then I'll make my decision right along with everybody else, how I personally feel.
Right. And have you ever voted against placing a bond on the ballot? Is there anything to lose?
No, I guess for anybody who, like, we received an email from someone asking us to not put it on the ballot. You know, if we did not put it on the ballot, likely then what would happen is the Recreation District would have to come back and ask for a property tax increase, which we could say yes or no to as well. But then it's really just five people, you know, making that vote. And only two of the council members live in districts that are affected by this tax. So I feel like for me, like, yet again, it's on my own perspective, but just I feel like putting it into the voters' hands and letting them decide is the best place to go. So I don't see the downside unless somebody just wants to prevent the people from even getting a chance to vote on it. I feel like the right place for something like this is for the people that would be affected, whether that's from a tax base or even from the recreational uses. You know, let them hear what the pros and cons are. Let the recreation district make their case, and then I'm good with whatever the people decide.
Yeah, and I know some council members shared concerns about the ongoing cost of maintaining something like a pool. Do you share those concerns?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything we do, if you increase facilities, even if you just bought another fleet vehicle, like there's always maintenance that goes along with it. So you add another room onto a building, it increases costs down the road. Certainly the council will have a voice in some of these conversations, and those are things that we will continue to probe and look into. But yes, if you build something, you're going to have to take care of it, and there's costs that go along with that. So I think it was Councilmember Robinson who first brought it up, and then Councilmember Armstrong who seconded that opinion. And no, they're absolutely right. That's something that has to be thought through.
Yeah. What about the idea that a concessionaire or some other company could come in and operate the climbing facility in Jeremy Ranch? Is it an existing gym brand or some other company?
We at the council meeting anyways, I'm not sure what they've shared publicly, but we didn't get into any details as far as how they would run operations on that. The one point that I heard made last night at the council was that that there will be lots of different activities that will go into the building. So it wouldn't be specifically climbing, or there wouldn't be one that's specifically a pool. I heard the director talking about was that they wanted to make sure that there was workout facilities and a variety of activities. How they would manage each or any of those, I'm not entirely sure yet, which I would say that would be part of what we'd have to ask them or inquire about.
Right. And I given all this, what's next? When will this come to council for a vote?
Well, it'll come August 5th. It will be styled as a public meeting, meaning that that's when people can come give public input. It will be held in the Richens building. So, and people can obviously join by Zoom, but that would be the one that you'd want to get to. Then Sutterville Basin, if we approve it, then Sutterville Basin Special Recreation District would have from now till November when it would be on the ballot to make their case why you should or should not, or I guess they would only make why you should vote for it. But, you know, that's when that conversation would happen. And then the people would vote in November.
Okay. What about the planning approval for the Jeremy Ranch Field House? It's part of the county's public-private partnership on the Klein-Dolly property, and that area has been quiet for several weeks now.
Yeah, that's still, it's not dormant. It's just very quiet. It's kind of chugging along. The idea is that for anybody who hasn't tracked on it, this is over by Jeremy Ranch Elementary School, and that we would have Habitat for Humanity would be one of the people that would build some housing out there, along with, oh my gosh, I just blanked out on our housing, the other housing authority. But we will have a couple people that would look at building some workforce housing. There'd be some for market housing. And then there's a piece of property there that the recreation district would put a facility on. And then I know they've talked about things from, you know, a pool. I've heard climbing. I've heard a gym. We'll have to wait and see what the final version of that is. But nothing's happening on it right now. So there's not a vote or a decision to be had now. They're just working through it right at the moment.
Okay. Can you kind of explain a little bit more about the rezoning policy that the council is considering adopting to make the Klein-Dolly planning process easier, just for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I wouldn't say the council is considering it. I would say it's more the planning department is proposing something that will come to the council, and then we will contemplate it. So it's just a slight difference in words, but and it hasn't come before us yet, so we haven't really dug into it. But what I understand is happening is there is a challenge when they want to build a project like that. The way the code is set up right now is you have to come in with the fully baked plans, and which means someone will have spent a lot of money to come up with these architectural drawings and that level of detail. And they want to this is just the general explanation of this, but what I've heard they want to do is get to where they can come in more with a concept. So instead of going into full architectural plans, come in more of like, here's what, an overview of what we're looking to do, and then make a zoning change potentially off of that. That's my understanding of it, but it hasn't come to council yet. So take it with a grain of salt. Once we get it in front of us, then we'll get the details and we'll wade through it.
Okay. I just want to clarify. I know something similar happened in Park City where they wanted to make it easier for their staff to take care of some of these planning things, and so they wouldn't have to go to RFP. So soon. Is that kind of similar, or does that sound different from this?
I think it sounds different. I apologize if, you know, because as we're just sort of reacting to it, but this is more not about an RFP, but more. So what happened is, this goes some years back now. I'm trying to remember if it was during the commission days or council days. I remember it was when Bob Richer and Sally Elliott and stuff were on the council or commission. They downzoned the entire county of all the county land to rural residential. And when they did that, there were areas that clearly were commercial, and they downzoned it to rural residential. And the reason they did that is, so if you want to rezone something, it's a legislative decision, and therefore it has to come before the council. And so this goes way back, but the decision was made to essentially force a developer to have to come in and negotiate, and when they try to get a rezone. And so that's how we got here. And then now we're looking at the way the policy's written around the rezone. There's too much investment of cost before they can even present what the idea is. I think that's different than what you're describing in Park City. I'm just not familiar with what Park City went through.
Okay, yeah, that's totally fair. I'm also wondering, how would this policy affect other pending developments in the basin, like the Junction Commons housing project? Has the owner of the outlet mall heard you're considering this change, since they want a rezone as well?
I believe that the outlet malls or Junction Commons would come before the council for a vote before anything on a possible change to the rezoning would happen. And I should say, for anybody tracking, you know, the concern about making rezoning easy or easier, there's, you know, sort of the devil's in the details. You have to, if you're going to try to make it so they don't have to spend all the money on full architectural details, you have to also make sure you don't make it easy then to rezone, or too easy to rezone, or to be able to bypass the council. So that's going to take a little bit of time for us to figure out. But I'm guessing, based on what I've seen from Junction Commons, they will come before the council before this would happen. So it probably won't affect them personally.
Okay. And just for those who don't know, can you kind of give an overview of what's planned for Junction Commons at the moment?
Yeah, sure. Junction Commons, which we all refer to as the outlets, if everybody's familiar, you know, it's got two circles, if you will. There's like the lower and the upper circle. Yet again, I'm giving this in broad strokes, so just know that. But they really want to take the upper circle and make that residential up there. It'd be mixed use. I think right now they've got 55 or 60% of the project would be affordable housing. Really could help in that sense. The lower circle where, you know, you see the retail components, they're trying to bring in higher end restaurants and stores. But basically what they want to do is get rid of these giant asphalt parking lots and make them more underground parking and walkable and have like, you know, sidewalks and grass and parks, and then put some more buildings in there. They want to cut open, not really cut open isn't the technical term, but they want to create openings in the sides of the circle, if you will, so that bicycle traffic and people can walk through. So really what they're trying to do is get some affordable housing into the project, fill in where the parking lots are, get rid of all the asphalt, and turn it into more of like walkable streets. It's one version of what they're trying to do.
Okay. And back to the zoning discussion, could you just explain some of the history behind why Summit County is zoned the way it is? I know there was an intentional effort to downzone, you know, years ago, but...
Yeah, it leads to a lot of confusion sometimes because it's interesting because, like, you might see a parcel of land that's rural residential, which means one home. I forget the number of acres, but it's like, call it 30 acres because I'm in the ballpark, but it's like you can barely put anything out there. It's just a big parcel of land. Well, when you look along the frontage roads as an example, all of that was put to rural residential. And at the time, the council didn't ever think that it would literally be just one house like sitting on this big lot. But it's really so that when someone comes in and wants to make it a rezone. This is what I was saying before, where it's legislative. That means when it's, there's two decisions to really make, administrative and legislative. And I won't get super wonky, but administrative is just kind when, like, oh, well, if it fits this criteria, the rules say you have to approve the rezone. Legislative is where you can free think and you can do a little trading and you can say, hey, look, if we're going to rezone, we want something like affordable housing, or we want more affordable housing, or we want, you know, you just have that ability to have the conversation. So that's what the council of past was trying to do. They wanted to get it so that anytime someone came in with a parcel of land and wanted to develop something, that you'd be able to have a conversation like that at the council level, opposed to it just being administrative and just sort of getting pushed through because it checked all the boxes.
Right. And switching gears, I know the council was set to interview and appoint an applicant to the Wrap Recreation Grant Board. Did you guys end up doing that?
No, that ended up getting delayed. There was only one applicant, so we need to have more than one applicant. I mean, if it stayed that way, we could move forward, but we wanted to repost and get more people an opportunity to apply.
All right. Anything else you think we should know?
No, but I just wanted to say thank you. And if anybody has a question, if I said anything here that, you know, you have a question about, or email the county council. If you go to the county website and you go to the county council section, there's a link. And when you hit it, you'll email all five council members at once. And we really do read them and we'll respond to you there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks. Have a great day.
You as well.
Bye.
We've been speaking with Summit County Council member Canis Hart. And joining me in studio is Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward and Park City Planning Commission Chair Kristen Van Dyne. They're here to talk a little bit about Bonanza Park plans and an appeal of Park City Mountain Lift upgrades. Welcome, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just first wanted to talk a little bit about Bonanza Park. It's a mixed-use development planned for 5 acres at the corner of Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Road. Rebecca, can you give us an overview of what this project is?
The project that's proposed for the 5-acre site has been evaluated and discussed for a number of years about what the future site might look like. And over the 2025 fall and into the spring of this year, the City Council conducted several public meetings where they worked through some of the goals for the project. And and reviewed what those future uses might be. And they discussed the vision and goals that include affordable housing. There are 106 residential units proposed for the project, and 88 of those are affordable. They discussed outdoor areas for community gathering spaces and uses. And so there are outdoor areas, amphitheaters, playgrounds, an art pavilion. There's also a child care center and then spaces for arts and nonprofit uses.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that overview. And I know the Park City Council approved those preliminary plans in March. Now they're before the Planning Commission. Kristen, can you just explain a little bit about what the commission is tasked with and when it comes to this project?
Yeah, so it kind of follows the process for all of our master plan developments and conditional use permits that come through the commission. And really, we're looking for compliance with the land management code and the general plan. So it's really just breaking that down through pieces and parts and looking at every individual section. We've gotten through a couple sections so far, and we have upcoming meetings to look at traffic and other parts of the application. But really, that's our job. Our job is to look at the application before us and how that complies with our land management code.
Right. And I know there's been a growing movement of opposition against Bonanza Park. There's a resident group called Place PC that's advocating for a park to be on this 5 acres instead. They've been to public comment multiple times with the Planning Commission, and they recently started a petition, which they say has around 500 signatures, to stop the project from moving forward. Rebecca, can this petition do anything to stop the project, or how does this relate to the Planning Commission and what they're doing?
Yeah, well, this project will continue to go through a public process. It went through the 7 public meetings with the City Council, and now it will continue to go through the public hearings with the Planning Commission. And as Kristen outlined, the Planning Commission's role is to really review what was submitted for compliance with our general plan and our land management code. So there will continue to be public hearings throughout the process, and that will be the scope of the commission's review.
Okay, and for those that are advocating to have a park instead on this site, what would it take to prevent development on this 5 acres?
Ultimately, the Planning Commission will review the proposal for the requirements and compliance of our code and our plans, and then this project will return to the City Council for the final approvals.
So when it goes back to Council, they could theoretically be like, we don't want this anymore.
There will continue to be opportunities for public input throughout the process.
Okay. And Kristen, I did want to ask you to kind of go through some of the feedback the commission has received so far. Obviously, this opposition has been very vocal, but there are people who have, you know, voiced their support for the project as well. So can you kind of just give an overview of what kind of feedback the commission has gathered so far?
Yes, we have received quite a bit of feedback, which is great. We always love when we can get public participation, especially at Planning Commission meetings. A lot of our meetings are not so eventful, and so when we can kind of fill our chambers and have a lot of participation, we really appreciate it, and we love that Park City gets involved. And so with this one, we've received quite a bit of both feedback in chambers during meetings for public comment, as well as emailed public comment, and we always make time to read all of those before we attend our meetings. And it has gone both ways, which we expect with an application like this. And I think some of the most helpful feedback is, again, looking at the application and giving feedback as it pertains to how we also process the application. So again, we're looking at it through the land management code. So feedback that really kind of addresses that is the most helpful. We appreciate all feedback and all public comments, but really looking at it through that lens, which is hard. I think we take a lot of time to learn to look at it that way. And so for the public, that's kind of an education point of seeing compliance. But it also, public comment helps us kind of frame our questions too. So we see stuff sometimes that we may not think of and be like, oh, that's a great point. I can address that with the developer. So all public comment is welcome public comment, but really kind of targeting that compliance with the land management code is super helpful.
Okay, and I know a lot of commenters have been, and the commission as well, has been discussing building height. Right now, the buildings are, I believe all of them are over the 35-foot maximum zone for this area. And I believe that it's up to 40 feet with these like additional aesthetic things. But can you kind of give an overview of why the building height is such a big part of this conversation? And why people are concerned about it, maybe?
I think rightly, we're always concerned about height in town, especially in that entry corridor. And again, we're still working through the application. We haven't decided that the height is acceptable yet, and we're really working with the developer to figure out what is the best height for this area and how we can make this the most suitable kind of plan to fit this site. Again, we always emphasize having a project that fits the site, not make the site fit the plan. So I think the time we'll see. We still have more public hearings and more comment and more time to really look at this application with upcoming meetings.
Right. And one of the most interesting things to me with the building height discussion is the developer is saying that it's really difficult to make a three-story building under 35 feet. And just because of modern building standards, Rebecca, I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is a new type of project for this area where they're proposing a mix of uses. And so there are commercial and nonprofit and some restaurant and retail spaces on the ground floor. So one of the design components of the developer does increase that first floor height. And then some of the exceptions that they're requesting are decorative elements. And so the Planning Commission's input in the last meeting was to really evaluate those decorative elements that are contributing to increased height and to explore possibilities to reduce that. And the developer will also walk the Planning Commission through why they're requesting the interior height that they are.
Okay. Another big topic with this development is the traffic. And I know that the commission hasn't really dived too in depth into this yet, but I'm wondering if you can give us a little overview of what that conversation is about, what kind of the traffic plans are for the project.
So the applicant is required to submit a traffic impact study for a development like this. And as part of that, the applicant also has an opportunity to submit a plan of how they've designed the site to really accommodate bicycle and pedestrian connections, transit connections, and walkability within the site and connections to the neighborhood to help mitigate and reduce some of the impacts of traffic. And then also parking and the proposed uses will be part of that evaluation. So the applicant is preparing to present their plans for the site. We know from the traffic impact study, this is a really challenging intersection and it will require really careful care and attention to detail to look at the circulation of this project and to mitigate the impacts of the development to the degree that we can.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to add, Kristen?
Nope, not too much. We saw kind of a preliminary right before our last meeting, but I think we're still waiting on a lot of information right now. So I think it's at our next meeting, Rebecca, we'll get really into the traffic, and I think that's going to be a really important meeting to kind of look more into this development and how it fits into the area.
Yeah, and I know that part of the project does include transit. I mean, they are planning to kind of, if I understand it correctly, add a bus lane into that side of the road so that the businesses on the other side of Bonanza aren't impacted. Is there anything else that you think people should know about plans for the project?
The city's website, the planning webpage, includes a summary of the project and also lists the upcoming dates of the meetings and how the community can participate and follow those meetings. Public comment can be submitted to planning@parkcity.gov. And then the developer team also has a website that they've created that really tells the story of what they're trying to accomplish with the site. And that's 5acresite.com, and that's the number 5acresite.com.
Great, and I know there's a bunch of renderings there too if people want to see what this might look like. And I also wanted to ask, when might the commission make a decision with this project? I believe it could be in August 26th, is that right?
The next meeting is scheduled for August 12th, which will be a public hearing, and another meeting on August 26th, and we'll see how those go with the commission. Ultimately, they will take the time needed to fully review the project.
Great. And moving on, there's an administrative hearing today at 10 a.m. on Park City Mountain Lift upgrades. The Planning Commission approved changes to the Silver Lode, Eagle, and Eaglet chairlifts in May. Then some Park City area residents appealed the decision. Kristen, can you just give an overview of what these upgrades are and why the commission approved them?
Yep, so the application included upgrades to the current lifts at Park City Resort. So it's Silver Lode with an upgrade from a 6 to 8 passenger detachable lift, and then as well replacing the Eagle and Eaglet lifts with a realignment for the current fixed grip chair to a 6 passenger detachable lift, with also including a mid station unload. And so that was the project that was the application that we approved.
And you again just approved it based on the typical things that the Planning Commission looks like. Does it comply with code, that kind of thing?
Exactly. We spent quite a bit of time. We had a site visit. We had 2 public hearings on this item. And so after our review, we found that it complied with the code.
Awesome. And then I know the residents who appealed the approval are arguing that the commission unlawfully ignored evidence that the upgrades would contribute to overcrowded and unsafe conditions at the resort. And they're saying that this is shown through carrying capacity data that was not included in the application, though it was in a different application 4 years ago. Rebecca, can you kind of explain why the commission didn't look at comfortable carrying capacity and how this application differs from this other one 4 years ago?
So Park City Mountain's development agreement establishes an administrative process for certain lifts that are shown in a mountain upgrade plan. And in 2022, the resort applied for an administrative permit, which is reviewed at the staff level. And through that administrative process, there are 6 specific criteria in the development agreement that are reviewed. 4 lifts that are not in conformance with the mountain upgrade plan, the development agreement provides the applicant an opportunity to submit a conditional use permit. That does require a heightened level of review. Staff no longer has authority to review the application. So earlier this year, Park City Mountain submitted 2 conditional use permits for their lift replacements, and those went to the Planning Commission for review in conformance with the development agreement and the requirements of the Land Management Code, which also includes a section specific to lifts.
Okay. I think that's everything. Like I said, that hearing is at 10 a.m. today, so we'll see how that administrative hearing officer decides on this appeal. Is there anything else that you think the community should know about related to planning, even if it's not these 2 projects?
I think visiting our webpage, we'll continue to update that as the 5-acre site moves through the review process. And again, public comment can be submitted to planning@parkcity.gov.
Great. Anything else, Kristen?
Nope. We look forward to seeing people in chambers at our upcoming meetings.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward and Planning Commission Chair Kristen Van Dyne. And on the phone with me, I've got local singer-songwriter Harry Lawson, a.k.a. Peach. He is here to discuss his upcoming show and his writing process. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So I wanted to first talk a little bit about your upcoming show tonight at Park City Mountain's Canyons Village. Can you just give us a little more detail on what the show is, when the show is, and kind of what people can expect?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, tonight starting at 5:30, we got 2 acts at Canyons Village. Aspen Ananda is opening the show, and then I'll be going on around 7. playing a bunch of music. We got like 23 songs lined up for it. I'm super excited to, you know, bring this show back to Park City where I grew up and, you know, just perform for some familiar faces and hopefully some new ones too.
Yeah. So I, like you said, you're a Park City native. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into music and what it's like to perform in your hometown?
Yeah. So going to Park City High School, you know, I was playing football, skiing, the whole thing, you know, that most of us do here in Park City. And me and my buddy just started writing songs just for fun. And it just kind of took over my life and I fell in love with it, fell in love with writing and, you know, just having an outlet to get the emotions out and do it somewhat creatively. And it's just kind of snowballed from there. And now I live in Los Angeles, so doing music full time, and coming back here is really a full circle moment because we used to come to these shows growing up all the time. So I'm really excited for it, can't lie.
Yeah, have you performed at, you know, in Park City a lot before at a stage this big?
So we haven't done any of these like summer series concerts, but we did perform a few shows over Sundance, like Flanagan's and some of those smaller bars. But this stage is awesome, and I can't wait to get on it. So, yeah.
All right. I'm wondering, are there any other like cool places you've performed at? Do you have a favorite spot that you've been to so far?
But yeah, this year we've done quite a few. Nashville was a really fun one. Last year we did the CMA Fest out there. So, I mean, every country act possible you could think of was out there, you know, putting on shows and stuff. That was a really fun one. Nashville's always a good time. I mean, that city is crazy. And especially for this country folk music that I'm doing, it really fits perfectly. But we did Boise this year. We did Anaheim. Anaheim was really fun. We did the House of Blues back in, I think it was like 2 months ago or something. But that one was probably one of my favorites this year. But I think today might overtake that on the list. I can't lie.
Yeah, I mean, nothing like your hometown, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you
beautiful
talk
up here?
Yeah. Can you talk a bit more about your writing process? How do you write the songs that you perform?
Yeah, like I was saying earlier, like it started just with my buddies down here, just in my bedroom, and I've kind of kept it pretty much the same. I write a lot of my music just in my apartment out in California, most of the time alone. And then, you know, now I recently signed to Capitol CMG in Nashville, so I've been taking a lot of trips out there for, you know, sessions in studio with other producers and writers, just kind of spreading out the wings a little bit and seeing what we can do collaboratively. But I like both sides. I mean, nothing can really beat the just kind of sitting in the bedroom and, you know, just soaking in the feelings and the emotions and trying to put them on, you know, to a good song that might resonate with people.
Yeah. Do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
Oh my gosh. That was, I think I was maybe a freshman in high school. That's a tough one. I had a few. I remember there's this one of them is still out. It wasn't my very first one, but there is one still posted. I don't recommend you go listen to it, but it's called Way Back, which that was the first song that I had released in high school, like on Spotify and everything. So there's a ton of them now. I mean, there's got to be maybe probably 110 something songs released, which is crazy, but I don't know. I like to keep some of the early songs up there. It really, you know, just reminds me of, you know, where it started and stuff. And, you know, listeners can go back and, you know, see the evolution of the art and the music. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering, what inspires you to make music? Is there something specific that you draw inspiration from?
At this point, it's really always just been, like, an outlet for me. So, like, just a way to, you know, get emotions out that maybe especially, you know, when I was younger, maybe wasn't, you know, didn't really have the ability to process or something like that. And if, you know, if I was sad or super happy or angry or whatever it was, it gave me like this productive outlet to, you know, fall into rather than, you know, whatever else people do to deal with their emotions. But it really is like an anchor for me at this point in my life. Like I do it almost every single day, writing songs, writing, you know, a couple lyrics down, whatever it is. And yeah, really, it really just keeps me grounded. And it's the way of life for me now. So, yeah.
All right. Well, is there anything else you think we should know?
But yeah. So before the show, if you guys haven't heard my music yet, I just released a project called Small Town America. So go check that out on all platforms. And we'll be playing all those songs tonight. So if you want to get familiar and sing along with us, they're out everywhere at Peach, P-E-E-C-H.
Yeah, and that again, that concert is tonight at Canyons Village. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
We've been speaking with local singer-songwriter Harry Lawson, also known as Peach. The small Wasatch County town of Wallsburg is bracing for a fight against developer-led towns. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports residents are upset about the possibility of major growth at their doorstep.
Utah is 2 years into a pilot program that gives landowners a new way to develop towns. In Wallsburg, a town of 300 people east of Deer Creek Reservoir, over 80 residents met Tuesday to discuss their concerns with the program. Among them was Shauna Raby.
Right now, we are up against Goliath, and that is that the legislature has passed a bill that gives a few developers all of the power over a community.
Raby and her neighbors were galvanized by a proposed development called Smooth Hollow, which they think could spell disaster for their quiet agricultural community. Application materials KPCW obtained through a public records request show the developer proposed 360 homes and 275,000 square feet of civic and commercial space. The new town would be built on land a couple blocks from the Wallsburg Town Hall. It was one of 4 new applications from the Wasatch PAC. The Lieutenant Governor's office can only allow 2 applications to proceed each year. Smooth Hollow didn't make the cut, but 2 other proposals in Wasatch County did. In January, landowners will have another chance to apply. Supporters say the program is needed to help address Utah's housing needs. Each preliminary municipality must designate 10% of its homes as affordable. Wallsburg residents are advocating for lawmakers to change or repeal the preliminary municipality law, which passed in 2024. Town Council Member Pete Nielsen says Wallsburg isn't the place for a new town.
It's okay to have property rights, but when it starts impacting everybody else in the community, that's when it becomes a problem.
Wallsburg local Tom Hicken is worried about the town's water supply.
Is there nobody that will actually pay any attention to the reality on the ground? Because if this goes through, they will not be able to fill their pipes.
Residents also raised concerns about roads and other infrastructure. Bob Morrison lives in Heber City near the site of Wasatch Highlands, one of the applications that was accepted. He urged state lawmakers to listen to locals over lobbyists.
My fear is the developers have so much power. You guys need to fight the developers, because they're the ones with the big money.
Utah Senator Kevin Stratton, a Republican representing Wasatch and Utah counties, invited county and town leaders to share resolutions opposing the pilot program. He also asked residents to be ready to speak up at the Capitol.
Quite frankly, we have a train wreck, and we've got to fix it.
After the meeting, residents flocked to join committees and sign a letter to the governor. Wasatch County locals aren't the only ones upset about preliminary municipalities. In Grand County, Moab area residents are suing over the program, arguing the law is unconstitutional. Meanwhile, 2 preliminary municipalities in Wasatch County are in the early stages of the incorporation process. Wasatch Highlands would include hundreds of homes east of Heber. The developer, Philo, previously brought the proposal to both the Heber City and Wasatch County councils without success. Now Philo is pursuing a different route to realize the plans. A population committee found Wasatch Highlands would have about 2,200 residents when complete. Near the Utah County border, Bear Canyon had to resubmit its paperwork to pursue plans for a resort community with about 1,000 residential units. The proposal needs a population study next. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Utah boasts Red Rock Trails and the greatest snow on earth, and now something else drawing tourists, wide open spaces with cattle and fresh produce. The Utah News Dispatch reports a new study from the state's Tourism and Agriculture Department found agritourism is growing. The industry is estimated to generate about $45 million in economic activity every year. Agritourism is a small part of Utah's $12.7 billion tourism economy, but the study says it's a significant asset for local farmers and rural communities. That includes communities in the Wasatch Back, making national headlines, like influencer Hannah Neelman's Ballerina Farm in Midway and Camas. And the study shows the state hasn't yet reached its full agritourism potential. The market could attract up to 300,000 visitors every year, and Utah is well positioned to reach those numbers. The most common activities among 100 agritourism providers surveyed for the study include field trips, corn mazes, pumpkin patches, farm and ranch tours, and animal experiences like petting zoos. You've been listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Christine Weller, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. Thank you so much for listening.